Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Orazio, and I welcome you to another episode of the Aperia podcast. I know I've been away for a couple weeks, but things have been a little hectic on my end, personal and professional-wise. Shit has been wild. But I think we're back on track now. Think that things are going to play out fine, and this shouldn't interrupt any future podcast. Except in May, I am going to take like a 2 or 3 week leave of absence because I have to travel. I probably could upload a podcast if I recorded my cell phone, but I really haven't considered it. I like having the nice audio quality. You know, once you have it, you never go back. And it took me like a decade to have good, decent audio quality because I'm an idiot and I didn't do the right research. But regardless, today's topic. We're going to talk about Nietzsche and history and the animal and Heidegger and a whole bunch of stuff. I recently wrote a paper for a class, and I kind of thought it was interesting enough to sort of go through parts of it here on the podcast. I thought it would be enjoyable. And also, you know, if I ever want to present it somewhere at a conference or something, this would be good practice. Speaking of which, I will have a podcast later on, maybe in a week or two, that I will be performing my presentation that I have to give in a conference. So it's going to be a good practice run session. So if you have any questions, I would greatly appreciate that because then I can practice in answering them. So if you don't know, please go to my Twitter, Aperia Podcast at Twitter, Aperia Podcast at Twitter. Well, I'm there. I haven't posted anything because I'm like terrible at social media. But I think in the summer, now that I have a little bit more time, I'll go ahead and be a little bit more focused on that. I'm not sure. I'm not gonna make any promises because this summer is gonna be crazy. I have to travel. I have to move to Brooklyn. I have to look for an apartment after I'm in Brooklyn. I might go to Queens. I'm not really sure. It's gonna be a very complicated summer. Let's figure it out. We'll figure it out later. So if you're from those areas and you have like any recommendations, again, hit me up on the Twitter. So, Nietzsche and the animal. Nietzsche's relationship to animals is a little contentious at times. So when I was writing this paper and doing the research, there's at moments it seems very contradictory, and it shouldn't surprise us because when one reads Nietzsche, he's very easy to see that he may hold contradictory statements at certain moments throughout his corpus. You know, it's very hard for, you know, the professional philosophers to try and get a grasp, put a conceptual cage around his thought. And I think he did that deliberately, because he thought that philosophy should not be bounded in academia, but it should be something that is lived and it should be experienced and it should be for the purpose of life, not for doing research or, you know, intellectual bookkeeping. But if we sort of see through these contradictories, it doesn't really appear to be so contradictorial. Is that a word? Contradictorial? If not, that's a great word. Somebody should make that word. I think it's contradictory, but contradictorial is some, you know, I don't know. Hook me up with Webster's. Regardless. So at certain moments, there are passages where he sort of disparages the animals in comparison to the human being. One of the passages from Zarathustra is, "What is an ape to an animal? I mean, no, what is an ape to a human being? A laughing stock." Verbatim, right? "And what is a human being to the overman? Equally, a laughing stock and a thing of shame." So comparatively, in that passage, you're saying that apes, right, these animals are comparatively shameful and a laughing stock compared to the greatness of the human being. But as we're going to see throughout his philosophy, Nietzsche believes in this idea of the overman and seeing that this human being is a transitional character and not an absolute end in itself. So, when we are compared to the Overmen, human beings are a laughingstock and a shame. There are other examples of Nietzsche sort of making a mockery of animals. And I guess one of his most famous examples is the notion of the herd animal. Nietzsche looks at these herd animals in total and absolute disdain. Now, maybe it's because of the domestication that these animals have become this way, and Nietzsche will argue about the domestication of the human being by certain institutional forces like religion or the state. But still, it seems like he really has it out for any kind of herd animal. And he never speaks about these herd animals in a virtuous way until we get into the notion of history, but that's until later. So, what does it mean to be a herd animal, right? Well, a herd animal means to be herded. It means to be controlled. It means to have your will taken away from you, to follow the orders of other people, to give over to authority, and not really think for yourself, not act for yourself. And these are central claims and tenets in Nietzsche's philosophy. But then again, even in the herd animal, we see the contradiction here, because as much as he wants to demean the herd animal, he sees a virtue in the herd animal. In the uses and abuses of history for life, one of Nietzsche's really great texts, and it took me a long time to actually hear someone talk about this writing. If you want to look it up, it's in the Untimely Meditations. I think it's like part 1 of 4 or something like that. Nietzsche goes there and he basically opens up the essay saying that human beings are sort of jealous of the happiness that animals have. Look at these herd animals and they seem joyful without a care in the world. And he meditates on why this is a reason, and his conclusion is, well, it's because they actually know what forgetfulness is, and they practice forgetfulness in a way that the human being does not. The herd animal, or any animal in this case, has a limited memory. They only remember things so that they can pursue whatever goals and aims that they want. They want to go eat, they want to go to this specific watering hole, they will remember that, but they don't have a memory for how to act or comport themselves or behave themselves socially, for example, in a way that human beings do. So Nietzsche tries to put the animal as a counterexample of the human being, where the human being, on the other hand, is absolutely controlled by history and memory. He wants you to think that any single decision that we make is informed by our history, but in a very controlling and deterministic kind of way, if we let that conception of history remain so. So he's very critical of the notion of history at its time as a collection of facts, of this sort of grave digging for artifacts and just trying to recount of how did we actually get here. But there is this idea that it is absolutely deterministic in the sense that history determines what I am right now and I can't do anything about it. And it produces a staleness and a rigidity in human life that he absolutely abhors. So think about a culture example. Some have argued that in Nietzsche, the difference between an animal and a human animal, which he routinely calls us human animals, is the fact that we have culture. And what is culture? Culture is just a prescribed way of being. It is a way in which our ancestors and our society and our governments and our greater world has already told us that this is the way that one should comport if you want to be sort of recognized amongst one of us. So culture has a way of fossilizing, ossifying certain ways of being. And it limits or it obscures new possibilities of ways of being, new possibilities of ways of acting, of being moral, of being, energetic for life. Because in our culture, we want to maintain that culture. We want to sustain it. But the only way we can actually sustain it is by actually performing what the culture tells us to do and never deviating from it. Because as soon as we deviate from it, it becomes a risk and it becomes an actual threat to the culture itself. It puts the culture's existence at stake. And if this isn't squashed down, if this isn't repelled, then that culture is very much liable to die. And this is why we have these power forces in our societies that try to maintain these cultural, social bonds, right? And for Nietzsche, he thinks that Christianity or religion is one of these cultural moments that really stifles us in the fact that it makes us at a very existential and even at a spiritual level, it threatens us with orthodoxy, with dogmatism. And if you get away from orthodoxy or this dogmatism, then your life is at risk because, again, they would kill you back in the day. Your social life is at risk because they will ostracize you, and you will still be ostracized in certain areas, even in this world. And even your spiritual life isn't safe because they will tell you that even after you die, even after you conformed your entire life in your bodily, physical form, there's going to be eternal consequences as well. You're going to go to hell, for example. So these religious institutions and all other kinds of different institutions, all these social and cultural forces act to reify what's already there. And history plays a large force in this because when you ask yourself, well, why am I doing this? Well, it's because I have a history of already doing this. My parents did it. My family and friends did it. I have a personal history there. So Nietzsche sees in the animal as this counter force to human existence. And he does see, and, you know, he does sort of have an ontological argument here where he does seem to say that we are a human animal, right? Like, nobody doubts the fact that we are animals, right? We've known this since Aristotle, right? Our genus is Animalia, but our species is human being, right? Because we have a difference from other animals. Nietzsche sees this difference as sort of not being so complete and absolute. In the beginning of Zarathustra, he tells us that man is a rope between the animal and the overman. So there's not a complete separation, but, you know, within the human being, the animal or animality still resides. And within the human being, the overman is a possibility. So because we are still possibly connected to our animality, this means we will always have the possibility of accessing the virtue of animals, which is forgetting. We can forget about these cultural and historical bonds in such a way that we can perform and act in new and novel and creative and artistic ways that is not so necessarily determined already. Forgetfulness for Nietzsche is a good thing. I see on the TV all the time, sort of commercials. Well, I used to. I don't have a fucking cable anymore, but I used to see commercials about like these memory pills, and especially because I used to watch like MSNBC, and like their audience is like these like 80-year-old people who have like memory problems already. So the commercials would literally always be about like how to improve your ways of remembering or stuff like that. In today's society, we sort of value memory. We value it academically, right? A lot of our tests is more about memorization than critical thinking. Memory, it's drilled into you. You have to have a good memory, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Nietzsche says, no, hold on. Maybe forgetfulness is a good thing because it allows us to forget the things we've already done. And we aren't beholden to them. So this opens up a new possibility for the future. There is a great article forgot the writer's name already, that sort of discusses this idea of Nietzsche's future man. See, the Overman is the future, right? So any sort of action is a projection to the future, and this is very, very reminiscent to Heidegger, which I will discuss in a little bit. So, but, you know, we can't have pure forgetfulness as well, because, you know, Nietzsche tells us that we need history. That's a literal quote. We need history via via Brachengeschichte. I think that's it. We need history. We need history. You know, we are human beings where we act with a purpose, and to act with purpose is to have a sense, a ground by which we can act, an understanding that's going to be directed towards the future, a new possibility. So it can't be pure forgetfulness like the animals, but it has to be in between. So he thinks that he has a very good quote here. Let me see if I can find it real quick. So the principle, so he has this principle that any new conception of history will follow the principle that for this quote, that for the health of a single individual, a people, and a culture, the unhistorical and the historical are equally essential. You need both of these counter forces to have a well-functioning, healthy individual, or a culture, or a people, or a state, or any kind of thing that has to do with humanity. It can't be just pure memory. So at the individual level, right? I was reading this article about hysteria and Merleau-Ponty and his sort of disagreement with psychoanalysis, but basically the psychoanalytical take on hysteria is this idea of confronting a memory and replaying that memory inside your head over and over and over again, and never being able to sort of come to terms with it. You never are able to deal with it. You become hysterical, in a sense. You just replay the memory over and over again. You never really get over it. And this sort of leads to repression when you are no longer actively or consciously thinking about the idea over and over again, but it becomes repressive, and it sort of sinks into your subconscious, and it sort of, you know, it sort of peeks its ugly head and sort of informs your decisions, even though you're not aware that it is informing your decisions. And this is sort of the personal individual level that memory can sort of disrupt our lives, because we are moving into the future, but if we hold on to the past and never move on and just replay the same episodes over and over and think, well, maybe I should have done this, maybe I should have done that, I regret this, I regret that, then we're really just suffocating ourselves. We're really just putting ourselves in a nice little coffin, because for Nietzsche, this is not living. Living is for the future. Living is action and consequence and result and effect. But also, you know, at a social level, some aspects of society are getting ingrained, and because we put the label of tradition or culture, we sort of don't question them. We just let it slide, and sometimes they are very harmful. You know, progressives, maybe this is the divide between progressives and conservatives, culture or social conservatives and progressives, right? So we need history, for sure, but we need a new conception of history that isn't just mere fact gathering, that isn't mere academic venture or pursuit, but it is a conception of history that will be helpful or serve us in our life as to engender action. And Nietzsche has three conceptions of history where forgetfulness plays a huge role. Which is very strange, because, you know, intuitively you think of history as trying to remember everything, but, you know, Nietzsche has already said that this is the wrong and a mistaken way of thinking about history, Geschichte. So the first conception of history that he wants to talk about is monumental history. Monumental history is for those who are in a current epoch or a current period where everyone seems to be really mediocre, where mediocrity and complacency and the herd abounds everywhere. So if you see that in your society everyone is so docile and domesticated, how is that going to inspire you to change things, to create new ways of being? Well, Nietzsche says, well, even if there are no more great men, and of course it's men because of the time period, if there are no great men, then you can go back into history and contemplate about the great deeds of these great men. Think about Julius Caesar. Think about Hannibal Barca. Think about, you know, think about Napoleon. Think about Plato. Think about Isaac Newton. Whatever. Think about all these great human beings. And what this reveals to us is that the possibility for greatness is always present, because it was already, if it's happened before, then it can happen again. And then this individual who's contemplating the past now has the recognition that greatness can happen once more, and hopefully this engenders history. Hopefully. I mean, this engenders new creativity, new artistic impulse. So they are reassured, even though presently in front of them, like, nothing is happening. Stuff has happened in the past, and it could happen again, and greatness is always a possibility. Nietzsche has a pretty good metaphor that the monumental history is like taking a look at a mountain range and only considering the peaks to be history. And it has to do this because it has to forget about all the valleys and all the in-between spaces and all the time and all the history and all the little specific minute individual facets of human life that are not great, that are just mundane and boring and average. This right here allows me, this new conception of history allows me to sort of forget about the mundanity of the past. Allows me to forget the mundanity about the present so that I can see the greatness of the past and try to bring it to the future. But Nietzsche says, yeah, okay, so this is a good conception, but there is a problem with it in the sense that it is too violent, even for Nietzsche, you know. This conception of history does so much violence to history. It does so much violence to the particular, to the individual, to the non-universal. It's also dangerous because the greatness is not universalable, something like that. It can't be made a universal. It's only these very specific moments. It can't apply for every single human being. So you have to sort of forget about every human being. So it makes kind of life a little bit trivial if you can't be great. So that can sort of put a block in your own life. If you think your life sucks and it won't be worthy of remembrance, because let's be honest, not every human being is going to be great, then this sort of engenders a spirit of nihilism, which for Nietzsche is one of the most, it's an anathema to him. Nihilism is the worst thing that we could actually experience or go through. It is a fact of life, but you can't do it. So Nietzsche has another conception called the antiquarian conception of history, where you try to preserve all the small, minute, little details. You preserve everything. Something it preserves all the aspects of the history, all the aspects of past cultural life, past societies, past civilizations, past ways of being, because the antiquarian sort of reveres these preserved notions because he knows that these have brought him here. He reveres these things because he knows that these are the causes for his existence. And because of this great reverence and great sort of honor that he pays to the past in trying to preserve it, this engenders a spirit of creativity. In a sense, he wants to continue it, right? So now there's a plan of action here, looking back in the history. The problem with the antiquarian mode of history is that it takes everything to be as important. It takes literally everything that's ever happened in history to be as important as anything else. And for Nietzsche, this is a problem because this is a sort of leveling down. It takes the real, actual great moments of human history and sort of levels them down and puts them at an equal footing to all the other average and everydayness. So it's the reverse, right? So in the one way, the monumental history and the antiquarian history sort of supplant each other, because both of them, by their own selves, are troublesome. They either only consider the great, or they consider everything as great, and then there will be nothing great. Nothing truly great. There is no distinction between things anymore. The last motion of this notion of history that it has is critical history. Critical history is looking back at the history and being, again, very critical of it, being sort of dismissive of it, of trying to reinterpret it, trying to think of ways. You know, we always hear about the, you know, people going back in history and sort of rewriting the history books, right? So we can be critical, because sometimes in a current moment, if you understand the historical direction that has led us to this moment, now we are stifled in our actions because we have to sort of pay heed to that history. But if we are critical of it, and we can challenge that history, then we have a different conception of history than what we actually have, and then this allows a new possible way of being. So think of what's a pretty good, and like, this is very popular notion right now. You know, I see this on, you know, all these like BuzzFeed articles and all this stuff, like things that you were taught in high school about history that turned out to be differently. Right. So you were taught in high school one specific way of history, and then usually when you go to college, you find out that it was all bullshit, that it's a lot more direct. And, I mean, a lot more complicated and not direct. There's a lot of, you know, moving factors here. So the oversimplification of history needs to be challenged, and there needs to be this sort of investigation into history and to see what actually happened. And sometimes we need to overthrow our entire history of history, our entire notion of history. What we thought was the actual case, it turned out to be different. But critical history also, you know, has the problem that the antiquarian history sort of solved. We need a basis. We need we need material to act. So no sort of action comes out of nowhere. The antiquarian, by preserving all moments of history, gives us a catalog of ways of being from which we can sort of jump off. Like, this is our board, and now this is what we've done. Now I can do something else, without sort of pretending that this is like the same thing or a new thing. Critical history has the possibility of demolishing all history, of sort of making shit up, where it's not a question of truth anymore. It's just what serves our purposes. So, while it is very beneficial in one sense, right, it can be very pernicious in the other, especially if it is being controlled by some sort of power. It rewrites history, it destroys it, and removes it, and creates a new history to serve its own purposes. So Nietzsche he goes on, but I think for the purposes of this podcast, that's as far I will go. So again, history, strangely enough, involves moments of forgetfulness, of the possibility of forgetfulness, because we are possibly animal. And I just find it very so interesting that he was able to derive new conceptions of history, of new ways of approaching history, through the fact that we are animals, through our animality. People always like to say that we're not animals, that we're something different, but this difference in itself, this supposed difference, can cause a lot of problems. It causes stagnation and stasis and rigidity and dogmatism. that, you know, all these nonconformists always are talking or trying to speak out against. And it is our animality, the fact that we are animals, and within us we can access this, the virtue of the animal, which is forgetfulness, that allows us to break away from these social bonds a little bit. It gives us breathing room to act, to renew, to create art. So the ramifications of a new conception of history are plentiful, right? So new art, artistic living, seeing history not as an academic venture, but actually an artistic creative process. Politically, this serves as a great tool for revolution and uprisings and resistance, because a lot of the arguments that you hear from the status quo is that this is the way things are, and this is the way things should be, because this is the way things are. But if you can forget about how things are in a healthy way, where it's historical and unhistorical at the same time, then you can start moving away from the status quo. Then you can start practices of liberation. It's sort of a little bit of a Marxist critique after Marx. It's weird. It's strange. I need to like read a book on Marx and Nietzsche. So interesting, very interesting. I was gonna get into Heidegger, but I'm like, this is like 31 minutes, and that would take us too far afield. Basically, what I was gonna say is Heidegger's opinion is that we are solely historical beings, that we are not animals. That Dasein, or the being that we are, is differentiated wholly, entirely, inseparably from other animals, from the fact that animals don't have a world, and that we do. We have a world of meaning, of culture, of history, of ethnicity, of projection, of discourse, of Dasein, where animals don't. They have an Umwelt, but this Umwelt is very naturalistic and biological and an environmental way of being, where the animal is sort of always stuck into the possibilities that its environment affords it in the way that humans are not. The world is what allows us the possibilities, but the world is not the earth. The world is not the environment. It is a world of meaning, of sense, of being, a ways of acting. It's not a world of plains and plateaus, of swamps and jungles. That definitely is a factoring in it. But, human beings have this great capability of living anywhere. We live in the jungle. It's one species, but we live in the jungle, we live in the desert, we live in the Arctic, we live in the swamps, we live in the plains, we live in the mountains. And then what we do there, we create different worlds of meaning. So the meaning of the world in the jungle is radically different than the meaning of the world in Antarctica. We do different things, we wear different things, we have different cultures, different languages. And with animals, it doesn't seem to be the case. You can't you take the penguin out of the Arctic and throw it to the desert, and A, they'll probably die, but two, they might not start acting like penguins anymore. I mean, they'll probably still act like penguins anymore. They'll die. Honestly, they'll just die. Let's just leave it at that. They have no sustainability in a different environment than the one that their biological naturalism, natural selection sort of decided for them. This environment is good for you. But if you get away from this environment, you'll kind of die in a way that the worldhood of Dasein isn't really like that. So a world can die. For example, your girlfriend leaves you. You were very invested in this relationship. You acted in a certain way to direct yourself to her and that possibility of that relationship. So you sort of fabricated your entire life pointing to this sort of relationship, right? You move closer to her, you're studying close to her, etc., etc., etc. So you shape your entire world in reference to that one specific possibility, which is being with your girlfriend. Now, until the relationship ends. Well, that possibility is not a possibility anymore. And every aspect of the world that you sort of catered toward that possibility also loses its meaning. It becomes an encumbrance. And actually, you feel really bad about it. This is why, like, after a relationship, you try to, like, you remove pictures or you put stuff away, you hide it, you bury it, dig it, you throw it away. Because again, you want that remembrance of the possibility that's not a possibility anymore. Because it still is a possibility. Because that's the world. It's an ontological structure. But ontically, it's just not a possibility. The relationship was broken. Doesn't make sense anymore. It's not a real, quote unquote, real factual possibility, but ontologically, it's still a possibility. So in a sense, that world that you crafted, that was centered around this, this very thing that you wanted the most, dies. In the very sense, and I have argued this before, and I've written a paper on this, you die. Your conception of who you are dies. Because now you don't have those meanings that were a sort of stable basis for you. And it dies, it goes away, and it withers and perishes. It dies. But because we are ontological beings, right? The structures of the possibility of worldhood is always there. So we are always going to be in a world. It's just not going to be that specific in a world. So once you sort of get over the sort of the breakup period and you start moving on, and you go on Tinder, you get a couple of days, shit goes well. You start building a new, you start building a new world, you start building a new life, a new identity for yourself. Sure, things are going to pass over, but again, you're being directed to new possibilities, creating a new world. But animals can't do this. They forget who they are immediately. So in a sense, even because I have a new world, I still remember what happened to me in the past. I will always remember what happened to me in the past, and which was the condition of the possibility for this new world. And even before that, all the worlds, all the history, all of human history were the conditions of the possibility for me right now. And technically, I'm still open to them. I'm still open to those worlds. I don't. They're not gone. I can't literally forget about it. Like ontologically, there is no forgetting. I think in Heidegger, there's no forgetting, even in death. Dasein will remain, especially when, because Dasein is prior to any factual living human being. So, yeah. Yeah, when I realized that, that was a brand new world with Heidegger. When I realized that we aren't actually Dasein, but there's like we come out of Dasein, which was a sort of a later modification in his philosophy after being in time. So, does that make sense? I don't know. I was rambling. I don't know. I still really haven't pointed down this whole Heidegger bit. But basically, what I want to say is ontologically, we can't forget. And ontologically, we can only remember. Factually, ontically, like real life existence matter, we can forget, but we really don't. Like, I can't forget things. We can repress things, sure. But forget things, that's rough. Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. It's weird. I haven't really worked this out entirely, but this is the sort of the extra stuff. This is the freestyle theorizing. Anyways, all right. See, this is what happens. I literally stopped paying attention to the fact that I was doing a podcast and like doing a podcast. And that I needed to be presentable, and then I just started thinking out loud. Anyway, we got it. Anyway, so I hope you enjoyed this podcast, this episode of the Upper Real Podcast. If you have any questions, concerns, comments, please follow us at the Upper Real Podcast. Fuck, yeah. Operate a Podcast at Twitter. So follow me there. If not, I'll see you guys and gals probably next week or something. I don't know exactly what the topic is going to be for next week, but should be good. Regardless, take care.